As the Germans approached Stalingrad, Stalin feared that the Transcaucasus front between the Black and Caspian Seas would collapse, yielding the oil fields, possibly bringing Turkey into the war and tempting the restless Caucasian peoples to rebel. Stalin turned to Beria. "Lavrenty Pavlovich," he respectfully addressed him, "take with you whoever you like and all the armaments you think necessary, but please stop the Germans." The generals were contemplating a strategic abandonment of the city of Arjanokitsa when Beria, accompanied by his posse, arrived there to terrorize them. "I'll break your back if you mention a word of this retreat again. You will defend the town." These generals, all writing after Beria's downfall, complained that his progress along the front was simply showiness and noise, which seriously disrupted their work. Beria also had to destroy any oil that might fall into Nazi hands. Back in Moscow, Stalin summoned Nikolai Bybakov, deputy commissar of oil production. "You're responsible, on the pain of losing your head, for ensuring no oil is left behind. But Bybakov would also lose his head if he destroyed the oil too early." As he left, with his head spinning, Stalin added, "Do you know that Hitler has declared that without oil he'll lose the war?" "I was just weighed down by the great responsibility," said Bybakov, who was not afraid but perhaps should have been. "I underestimated the danger of my personal position." The correct oil fields were dynamited, with minutes to spare. Bybakov kept his head. The Germans attacked Stalingrad by land and devastated the city from the sky, destroying that industrial leviathan in an infernal bombardment that converted its stark factories into a primeval landscape of caves and canyons. Stalin was beside himself, berating his envoys to Stalingrad, Malenkov, and Chief of Staff Vasilevsky. "The enemy broke through with small forces. You have enough forces to annihilate the enemy. Fight! Day and night! The most important thing now is, don't panic, don't fear the impudent enemy, and keep up your confidence in our success." The gravity of Stalingrad finally concentrated Stalin's mind to realize that the road to survival and glory lay with professional generals instead of his own impatient amateurism and his bungling cavalrymen. On the 27th of August, he ordered Zhukov to rush to Stalingrad and promoted him to Deputy Supreme Commander. Zhukov refused the promotion. "My character wouldn't let us work together." "Disaster threatens the country," replied Stalin. "We must save the motherland by every possible means, no matter the sacrifice. What of our characters? Let's subordinate them to the interests of the motherland. When will you leave?" "I need a day." "Well, that's fine. But aren't you hungry? It wouldn't hurt to have a little refreshment." Tea and cakes were brought in to celebrate the beginning of the war's most successful partnership. Zhukov met up with Vasilevsky in Stalingrad, where he found the Germans creeping into the city. Stalin demanded counterattacks, but his forces were not yet up to it. Stalin was so anxious that he now slept on a couch in his office, with Paskryobyshev waking him every 2 hours. He was so pale, tired and skinny, that Paskryobyshev let him sleep an extra half hour because he had not the heart to wake him. "A philanthropist all of a sudden. Get Vasilevsky on the line, quick." Stalin yelled at Vasilevsky, "Don't you understand? If we surrender Stalingrad, the south of the country will be cut off from the center, and we'll probably not be able to defend it. Don't you realize that this isn't only a catastrophe for Stalingrad? We'd lose our main waterway and soon our oil, too." But its importance was not merely strategic. Stalingrad bore his name because it had played a formative part in his life. There, in 1918, under its old name of Tsaritsyn, he had gained his confidence as a man of action, learned how to govern by terror, won Lenin's trust and Trotsky's hatred. At the Red Verdun, he had met his cronies from Voroshilov to Budyonny and embarked on his marriage with Nadia. "I think there's still a chance we won't lose the city," replied Vasilevsky carefully. Stalin ran Zhukov and ordered the attack. "Delay's equivalent to a crime." When Zhukov reported that there would be a delay, Stalin sneered, Do you think the enemy's going to wait until you bestir yourselves? At dawn, the Russians attacked, but made limited gains. The Germans had almost taken the city. Only one force stood in their way. The 62nd Army, under General Vasily Chuikov, clung on to the Volga's west bank, commanding from dugouts and fighting in the skeletal ruins of an apocalyptic industrial landscape supplied only by ferryboats that crossed the burning Volga, in which the destiny of Russia was reflected. They fought with modern weapons and ancient ones, sniper rifles and grenades, spades, pipes and fingers, dying to win time. "Blood," said Chuikov, "is time." In one of the most intense battles ever fought, Chuikov's direct commanders were General Andrei Yeryominkov and Commissar Khrushchev, but it was much too important to be left to them. Stalin himself supervised the front, with Zhukov and Vasilevsky in active command, while Malenkov acted as his personal spy. "I'd notice Vasilevsky and Malenkov whispering," said Khrushchev, preparing to denounce someone. Malenkov summoned officers to Yeryominko's dugout to reprimand. One was Vasily Stalin, who, though banned from flying active missions himself, was commanding a division. "Colonel Stalin," Malenkov said, "the combat performance of your flyers is revolting." Then he turned to another officer. "And you, did you intend to fight or simply play around?" After Malenkov had gone, Khrushchev and Yeryominko would be left alone again in their dugout, in an eerie silence like a forest after a storm. It was Khrushchev's finest hour, living in his dugout, building the friendships with generals that were to be so useful after Stalin's death.